for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Masters by C.P. Snow has been called the best academic novel in English. It's set in a Cambridge college in 1937. Talk outside the college is of appeasement and imminent war. But inside, former friends become enemies as the election of a new master looms. Joining me in the studio for this month's Reader's Review, Milton Greenberg, Professor Emeritus of Government at American University, Francis Steed Sellers of The Washington Post, and Philip Terzian of The Weekly Standard. Since this is a Reader's Review, we do welcome your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Philip Terzian, how did you like this novel?
I liked it a lot. I can't say that I loved it, but I found it very interesting. I read it, as you did, more than 35 years ago when I was an undergraduate. And not long after that, I was briefly a graduate student at actually Oxford, not Cambridge. So it had some interest to me in that sense.
The two readings, how did you feel about it the first time as opposed to the second time?
Well, it intrigued me the first time because it was anthropological. I mean, how does this culture operate in a separate country, a very rarefied atmosphere? I was interested this time in rereading it, having now descended well into middle age and past, that how the personalities were depicted and how in some degree they mirrored people I've known under comparable circumstances. So in that sense, I thought as a novel, it held up better than I expected.
Francis, how about you? Did you enjoy reading it?
I love this novel, I have to say. Now, I think when we go on, we can talk a little bit about some things like character development and the representation of women and some other issues where I think there are some somewhat cardboard characters. But the whole atmosphere of the college and how that resonates now was fascinating to me. And
Had you read it previously?
I had not read it. As if I had heard it from relatives and lived it in some ways.
So. I see. I, too, Philip, read it about 35 years ago and felt as though I was so drawn in by Strangers and Brothers, the first in the series, and then went on to read this one, and I was just so intrigued. Milton Greenberg, as someone who has lived through the university system here at American University, what was your reaction to it?
I think that's why I loved it so much. I found myself reading very slowly, absorbing the words in terms of what I know from my experience, and enjoying the realities of ambition and disappointment that characterizes the life of all academics.
And the competition that immediately emerges when we learn at the start of the novel that the master, he's not called the headmaster, he's called the master, has a terminal illness. And immediately before he is near death, the factions begin to form.
All right. That's the idea of the king is dead, long live the king. And everyone then immediately turns to the next person.
And, of course, as you think about turning to the next person. In this case, as you said, Francis, the women come into this. The women are not portrayed particularly nicely.
I think it's fascinating because they are very peripheral in some ways, and yet they're central to the advancement of the plot. And Lady Muriel, the sort of ramrod aristocrat,
who controls the wife of Vernon Royce,
controls the moment when he will learn about his own fate. So it hangs in her hands, and yet we never really learn about her as a human being. Then Mrs. Jago, described, I think, as a shrew at one point, an objectionable woman, other things like that. And yet she in her hands lie the fate of her husband in many ways. And then we have this other female, Sheila, Lewis Elliot's wife, who seems in some way to control his life in that he goes back to London 2 days a week where he's a barrister. He's only 3 days a week in Cambridge. And she has this, the mystery of her life, which I know is revealed in other books. But again, she has a controlling influence, although she's not a central character. I think this is a sort of fascinating way.
But what struck me was that these women within this male-dominated atmosphere seem so peripheral.
Well, I think that's to some degree Snow's skill as a novelist, even though his literary reputation is not as high as it could be.
Or as it was.
Like many social realist novels, he wasn't much of a literary artist, and so his reputation has suffered a little bit in literary circles. But I think also the novel, we have to bear in mind, is a reflection of its time. It's set in 1937. I was sort of peripherally in that world 40-some years later, and I still am in touch with it. And obviously, Oxford, and I'm sure Cambridge, has changed tremendously. All the colleges are now coeducational. The university is more administrative and bureaucratic. It's a more small-d democratic atmosphere than it used to be. On the other hand, a lot of it still obtains. I mean, the colleges are still as unitary and they operate on their own the same way they used to. And there's that same small and closed atmosphere and tiny society of fellows that operates things. That hasn't changed so much, even though the personnel has changed. And in 1937, you wouldn't have had women. I mean, there's still vestiges of the days when fellowships depended on your not being married and so on. That is no longer the case. Women are now much more a part of the scenery than they used to be.
Can I jump in a little
bit
there? Sure,
go ahead.
Having come from a family where we've had 4 generations of women at Oxford, there were women's colleges going way back, in parallel with the men's colleges. So going back to 1870 or so, you found Lady Margaret Hall, Somerville, these other colleges in Oxford, at Cambridge, Girton. And Cambridge retains, I think, 2 female-only colleges. Oxford has given up on that altogether.
Interesting.
So there was this education of women alongside this very masculine society, which Philip describes so aptly, which was very separate from the two existed in parallel.
And of course, Milton Greenberg, your experience was totally different because American University has had women from the start.
Right. What interested me was not the talking of women, but there were no students in this academic novel,
yes.
Which is very interesting. Let me mention also, in connection with one of the nasty parts of that novel involving a wife, that in my own recruiting experiences, I got letters like that.
Did you
personal
really?
Letters, yeah. When people heard someone was being considered
for
a high position.
So it still happens.
Oh, yeah. There was nothing in that book
that doesn't still happen. That's why I find it such an educational novel, not just in the academic sense, but in the human sense. Mm. The kinds of envy, the kinds of jealousies, the kinds of put-downs, not just of women. I mean, you had those who felt that only science should be represented here, or only philosophy should be represented and feelings about the threat of war, which we understand is going on outside.
Absolutely. I think there's a moment where Lewis talks about war hysteria, the sort of feelings that are being played out on the national and international stage being reflected in some ways in this very microscopic way in this college. And that is a great gift. Having acknowledged that, I look at characters like Jago, who are described as humane. I'd love to hear Philip on this. Described as humane and interesting people, but I never really feel that in the novel. I didn't like Jago particularly.
Why not?
He never spoke to me directly. He was a victim of his own passions, his own ambitions. And we kept hearing from Lewis Eliot that he was this remarkable man to be admired. I didn't end up admiring him.
Well, that's to me, that was always the central weakness of the novel, that Jago, to me, seemed the least eligible candidate to be master.
We should say that he represents one faction. And to begin with, at least, he has a majority of the votes for master.
No, I mean, two or three of the masters, of the other fellows, are devoted to him. And it's never really made clear to me why that should be. He struck me as being semi-hysterical. He was exactly the sort of person you shouldn't have as master. And what is frustrating to me as a reader is that the omniscient narrator, Lewis Eliot, really is the one who ought to be the master.
Lewis Eliot, of course, as one of the central figures in The Masters. Philip Terzian is literary editor of the Weekly Standard. And welcome back. For our readers' review this month, we have selected C.P. Snow's The Masters. And I have to confess, it's one of my longtime favorite books. One of the first books I read when I really began to read. I think we all have times in our lives when reading becomes central. It wasn't early in my life, and it came later. And so reading this book then and reading it again now, really quite a revelation to me. C.P. Snow went on to write an 11-book series under the aegis of Strangers and Brothers. And this is the fourth in that series titled The Masters. Here in the studio, Frances Steed Sellers. She's editor for health science and the environmental coverage at The Washington Post. Philip Terzian is literary editor at the Weekly Standard. Milton Greenberg is professor emeritus of government at American University, where he served as provost and interim president. We'll take your calls. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You know, reading this, I found myself wondering who would want to be a master or who would want to be a president with all of the responsibilities incumbent in a position like that, Milton?
You have to love the institution. And then you can tolerate a lot. And you also have to be knowledgeable about elements of human behavior in the context of ambition, of disappointment, of imaginations of what you should be. And this is very commonplace in a university where everyone works very hard to get there. And they have sometimes a fantasy vision of what to expect.
And do you think that Jago's wife had that fantasy about what to expect, Francis?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this plays a little bit into the difference, again, between the master of this college that Philip described so carefully and an American liberal arts college, which is a very different thing, or an American university. So this is the master of a college which is part of Cambridge University and isn't actually responsible for providing the degree or much of the academic decisions, which are university-wide. In some ways, it's a more social position. And you can see that in Lady Muriel and also in Mrs. Jago's, ambitions. They want this position in the lodge where they will be receiving people and looking after the social welfare of the small community and interacting with other masters in other colleges. And so they're relieved of some of the academic burden that would fall upon a provost or the American equivalent here. And I think that's very telling in who would be the master and who'd want to be there.
Philip.
Yeah. It's often difficult to explain the Oxbridge system to Americans. It's sort of like explaining cricket to them. But it has to be
understood. I still don't understand that.
Well, in one sentence, Oxford and Cambridge are these collections of small colleges, all of which were founded at different times. Some are far wealthier than others. They all have different reputations, regional affiliations, wealth, social status, and so on. The life of a Cambridge college is unique within Cambridge and unique really within most university governance in the world. It's not at all like being president of the University of Michigan or something like that. It's very much a small elite matter of social status as much as anything else.
Social status, yes, but not salaried position. In that some of the college professors earn more money than the master does, and Jago knows that he will have to take a cut in salary if he wins this election. But it's the position that means so much to him, Milton.
That's right. One of my favorite lines in the book was rather obscure, I would suspect, to most people, but they are talking with a potential donor. And the donor says, after a lovely evening of wine and food, he says, you know, I would like to be part of this atmosphere. I'd love, perhaps when I'm done, to, you know, work in a place like this. And I have heard that all my life.
Really?
Because it grows out of a fantasy, an idyllic situation in which there is peace, there is no competition, there is a group of students who love you and crowd you, and that there are professors who spend their time all the time discussing Plato.
Well, it's the same illusion as turning away from the world and going into a monastery.
Sure.
Where you find that it's another snake pit of ambition and jealousy and mutual hatreds. And
but isn't that Sir Horace an interesting character? This is the potential donor who at at one point is
Lord Timberlake
looked down on Sir, maybe, as I'm not sure if he makes the Lord, but anyway, whatever. But you know, he's bought his way into dignity or whatever, as previous lords had done in generations past. But he's on one level looked down on, right, by these dons who are sitting around and need his money desperately. On the other hand, don't really, particularly the ones on the humanities side, don't really want his values. And they're doing desperately all they can to get his nephew through degrees and sort of please him so that they can fleece him.
Now, is that a contemporary situation or what?
Well, it is. But, you know, we've also been talking about the aristocratic principle, which is that there are some things that are more important than money, and the prestige and status of being the master means more than a salary that's £1,000 higher. And Sir Horace Timberlake is almost a cardboard character of a sort of gross capitalist who's made a lot of money, and now he's buying his immortality by endowing X college and so on. So, of course, all these pure academics are horrified by him.
You know, with respect to the size, there are only 13 fellows in this group. 13 fellows. A department in a university is usually larger than that.
Sure.
So that I can tell you, when I first became a chairman of a department many years ago, followed by a deanship, followed by vice presidency, followed by provost, and even an interim president. I'm only saying this not to give my pedigree, but to say that at each instance it was always the same. That is, the way you get treated, the way you're thought of, the attitude not only from within but also from outside the university. It's Dean so-and-so that makes you super important, and it affects your relationships with everyone in your unit.
But Jago sees the opportunity to be master as fulfilling an extraordinary ambition.
He is the only one, I think, who comes from an academic background. This is something that's bred into him. And I think one of the other very interesting things about this novel is the only person who seems really excited about his work is young Luke, right? The nuclear physicist.
Right.
The man
right.
who in the pre-war years is on the cusp of changing the shape of the world.
And here's an email from Marianne in Oxford, Ohio. She says she read the book as a young faculty member and her hair stood on end. She said they were everyone she had encountered at the university, including herself, and ends by saying, human nature and ambition do not change very much. So it is, in that sense, an every person kind of novel, even if you are not involved in a university setting, because what it does is to offer a glimpse of personal behavior and personal relations in a way that I find C.P. Snow to be, even within his spare language, his lack of depth in regard to Jago, tells us a lot about Jago.
Absolutely. I think we see him against this backdrop of other ambitious, political, conniving academics who'd like to see themselves as above it all, but they're clearly not.
Let's open the phones. We have a number of callers waiting. 800-433-8850. Join us as we talk about C.P. Snow's novel, The Masters. First to Santa Cruz, California. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. It's a privilege and a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to let your listeners and your panel know that I was a fellow of the oldest Cambridge College, Peterhouse, founded in 1284 in the late 1960s, and having read C.P. Snow's The Masters in 1962 as a grad student, I found myself as a prize research fellow at Peterhouse watching the Masters unfold before my very eyes.
My gosh!
Over a period of not one, but 2 years.
Huh.
And if I may briefly tell you about that experience.
Surely.
So I arrived to take in 1966 to take up the last 2 years of a three-year fellowship. I'd come back from Caltech, and I found that the master, Herbert Butterfield, had just announced that at the end of the academic year 67 to 68, 2 years away, he would resign from the mastership. And that set up a real problem for who would be his successor, because the person that many of them favored, a person who was a fairly distinguished mathematician, but unlike the scientist in Snow's novel, a man of great warmth, and he and his wife, German-born, before the war, had brought a couple of refugee children, sons, boys, from Germany and Austria, absorbed them into their family, educated them, and sent them on in the world, and also been a nexus for many refugees. And this man, Burkle, Charles Burkle, had held the college together, but because of the statutes, it turned out he failed by 1 year to satisfy a criterion, which was that when taking up the mastership, a master should be able to serve for a minimum of 3 years before attaining the age of 70. And unfortunately, having been born in 1900, he would be 68 at that time.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
it's characteristically English that they would not give him any sort of waiver under the circumstances.
Exactly.
Sort of like pub closings.
Philip Terzian, he's literary editor of the Weekly Standard, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. John, thanks for your call. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks very much for the show. My question is, I read not quite the whole series based on the recommendation of a professor back in the 70s. And my question is, should we be studying this series of novels, not only for its as literature, which it is very good literature, but also perhaps as an anthropological artifact that is very important about how we developed nuclear power developed, and just as a general study.
I think that's a good question, Milton Greenberg.
I'm not quite sure what
should this be assigned reading for young college students?
I don't know. It takes the gleam out of your eye a little early.
Does it really?
Yeah.
Too early.
So. Yeah, I don't think they would. Most of the students that I've had would really appreciate this.
What do you think, Phil?
I think it points to a weakness in Snow as a novelist, frankly, that if I were a teacher of literature and I wanted my students to read a series of English novels like this, I would read A Dance to the Music of Time by Anthony Poe, which was a much greater work of literature. However, having said that, Strangers and Brothers teaches you a great deal about 20th century Britain, and if you're studying England in the Snow era, it's a very good historical document. I think the Masters and one or two others in the series approach literature, great literature, in my opinion. But I don't think, from a literary standpoint, it would be. I think it's probably too much of an investment for an undergraduate.
Francis,
yes, I'm agreeing with Philip there, and also thinking how important it is not as a piece of literature, but in terms of introducing science as the sort of driving force of the second half of the 20th century, a theme that Snow obviously talked about in his famous Reed lecture in 1959 when he talked about the two cultures. But here you have this divide between the people and the humanities and the scientists. And the scientists are the ones who are going to bring us into the nuclear age, which, of course, we're seeing the fallout from now. They're also the ones who are going to lead advances. So Horace Timberlake notices that when he's talking about giving money to the college. It can't rest on that background of humanities, theology.
He wants science.
He wants science.
He wants knows the that's fundamental the future. Focus to be on science, and he wants to direct his gift, if you would, to science. Short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about C.P. Snow's novel, The Masters. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Dan Savage started the It Gets Better Project in response to reports about bullied gay teenagers committing suicide.
If there are 14 and 15 and 16-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds out there watching this video, what I'd love you to take away from it really is that it gets better.
On the next Fresh Air, Dan Savage and his partner Terry Miller join us.
C.P. Snow has written an 11-book series, the overall title being Strangers and Brothers. We're talking about the fourth in the series, titled The Masters. It's set in 1937 as the war is beginning to bubble up. There are those who believe that England should be involved immediately. There are those who are calling for appeasement. At the same time, in this small college, unnamed, is a battle going on for the head of the college when it's discovered that the master has a terminal illness. And by the way, we're back to the fact, Francis Steed Sellers, that you pointed out early on that his wife is in control of telling him, or when one might tell him, that he's dying. He thinks he's going to get better. How outrageous.
Well, absolutely outrageous by our standards.
And really?
Yet I think a practice that continued until not so very long ago.
I'm afraid so.
And she doesn't just keep it, of course, from him. She lets the rest of the college knows, and so they're forced also to keep it from him. And we have these scenes of one don after another going to visit the master and having to hold back the information
exactly.
they all know about his fate.
And Milton Greenberg, there yeah. is even talk of bringing in an outsider rather than choosing yeah. one from within the college to be yes. the master.
Yes, that is, I think, if the entire academic world had read the masters, they would always go outside. What it does is reduces the inattentions and people focus elsewhere. Just imagine in this country if every time a president was up for selection or a dean or a provost that they said we're going to pick someone from inside, you would have war. A major academic war.
Do you agree with that, Phil Terzian?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, sometimes it's a good idea and sometimes it isn't. As I say, one of the paradoxes of the novel for me is that it seems to me there are two or three fellows who would probably make a thoroughly satisfactory master who no one considers for a moment. We're concentrating on, although I have to say the person who does win, Crawford, seems to me perfectly suited to the job of being a master of a Cambridge college, even though it's a disappointment to the narrator.
Why does Crawford seem...
Well, he just struck me as being judicious and politically smart. And
I thought he was rather smug myself.
Well, but that's often necessary in that position. You have to remember this is...
I actually, again, getting back to the role of his family, again, it was very interesting. Lewis Elliott comments at one point that even though he clearly isn't a very attractive man, he's not going to have, you know, lots of women hanging around him. He has a very settled and pleasing domestic life, a wife and two children. Jago does not have children, and he has this rather embittered wife. And clearly the notion of a happy family in the lodge is something that the other masters think is a good idea.
A good idea.
He's also a scientist.
Absolutely. He's a scientist.
And that way, C.P. Snow can make some inroad on his great idea of the two cultures. And the fact that he is a scientist might explain his reticence, his character. Scientists don't tend to behave as humans.
They're not very emoting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the son of a scientist, but I can assure you there are exceptions to that.
Oh, sure.
But I always look, in a novel like that, I always look to see where the novelist appears. And I just on a tangent, I would point out that C.P. Snow is very, I mean, the novel is very English and very redolent of England. And Snow is a character of the 20th century. He was a poor boy who rose through the academic ranks entirely by merit. He went to a grammar school where everything, he had scholarships because he was a smart boy who did well on exams. He got to Cambridge entirely on scholarships. And he was a scientist, so he looks at this to some degree as an outsider when he's observing this medieval institution. And so another thing that I enjoy in it as a novel is some of the ancillary characters, such as the sort of doddering, semi-senile Mr. Gay, who's a fellow. He's treated sort of with slight horror, but also amusement and affection, and drawn very well, I think.
And Bidwell, of course.
Exactly.
Bidwell the servant, who will come up and actually has, you know, his eyes on the whose lights are on and whose lights are off around their own, and actually at the end says he, you know, that he and the other servants would have been fine with either of the two candidates that they're
How
both appreciated.
How privileged did this life seem to you?
Well, I think this combination, of course, of great privilege, the bottles of claret that are open, the wonderful meals.
I've never seen so much liquor
drinking.
In a novel.
And I have to say, much of that continues today. Yet at the same time, if I remember my own undergraduate years, or more my brother's, you know, and certainly this was true back in those periods, these dons would have sets, several rooms together, and they would entertain their students in those rooms for supervisions, as they were called. But they'd probably have an open fire, but the rest of the time it would be freezing cold. when we were undergraduates, you might go down a winding staircase for three flights at night to find a bathroom. It was not great luxury.
Well, it's but that's the Englishness of it for me, that, right. Which England has always struck me as a combination of shabbiness and grandeur. And here in this Cambridge College, I used to observe in where I was, you would have all this panoply and theatrical, there was a wine cellar and so on. And yet the dons all had sort of threadbare suits. I would have to cross two quadrangles to take a bath and so on. It was, high thinking and plain living at its best.
Good. Let's go to a caller here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I had two comments to make. The first one is that I think that you have all somewhat slighted the importance of the political element in this novel. I mean, the major political conflict in England in the 30s at that time was whether communism or fascism was to be considered the greater threat, which is what determines people's attitude towards the Spanish Civil War then in progress, which in turn is what ends up deciding the election.
Do you agree with that? Decides the election?
I don't. I mean, it's interesting. The so much is off stage in this novel. The undergraduates are just luggage in the porter's lodge and noise occasionally. And there's an occasional ancillary mention of the outside world. But I think in order to emphasize the insularity of society Snow is describing, they're not fleshed out very much.
Paul, you also mention Sir Timberlake. How do you feel?
I think he is a somewhat shrewder character than your panelists are giving him credit for. I think, in fact, that he's playing the fellows, and I think he understands the dynamics of their interaction much better than they do.
How so? Spell that out.
Well, he knows what he wants from them. And, you know, to a certain extent, of course, he's got this money to give away somewhere, and, you know, perhaps at some level he doesn't that much care, you know, where it's bestowed, but he is enjoying his power over it, and he is enjoying his power to put, you know, whatever strings he wants on the money.
Well, and the strings clearly have to do with his son.
Yes.
And he wants his son to get a passing grade.
Yeah.
Well, he wants...
Well, there are lots of pressures that come that way, particularly for admission to professional schools. People think if they give money and mention that their grandson is a candidate for law school or medical school, that will help. And a smart leadership will decline that.
It's rather unusual for an undergraduate to not get at least what used to be called a gentleman's third, which is what Brown is trying to get Sir Horace's relative. Is it a son or a nephew? I think he's a
nephew. I think it's a nephew.
But that's partly why the tragedy of Winslow's son is so moving, because his son doesn't get a degree at all. And after the years there and being nurtured, you see this embittered man talking about his son as such a failure, which is very hard, I think. He actually becomes, I'm seeing here, Philip might have something to add there.
No, I was shaking my head for another reason. Just in defense of the panel, I think we fully understood Sir Horace's motives, and I think he knew exactly what he was doing. The only point I was making was that the academics had a kind of unstated contempt for him, which tore at them, because they clearly wanted his money. Although I would add too that just as you can thrive with a gentleman's third in England, I was thinking young Winslow, if he spent 3 years at Cambridge, that was as good as having a degree in those days. So it didn't really matter.
Probably true. But aren't we all struck by the sort of amateur way that fundraising was done?
Yeah.
Of course, it continues now, but there's no development office. Now Oxford colleges and Cambridge colleges have development offices, but they're still way behind the way it's done here. And there's a great deal of discomfort still in Britain about being asked for money in the way that Americans know. You know, if you go to college here, that you'll get that letter, you'll get that phone call, and you can decide whether or not to open your pockets. But there, it's quite a different matter.
You know, there's one other historical concept that should be said. The book was written in 1951. by that time, the American higher education system was nothing like it is today. And it was small, it was liberal artsy, it was private. And then suddenly, with the GI Bill and the booming concept that everyone ought to go to college, we have a whole separate concept of higher education.
Yeah, so absolutely.
It doesn't, a lot of this, what goes on in the novel, doesn't tell us much about higher education. But what it does show, especially in the older people, we all want respect.
That's true. That's true. Let's go now to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I think that it's important to look at the Masters as a wonderful political novel. And I know you've talked about it being an academic political novel, but I think that it reflects the real world of politics, particularly the world of legislative caucuses, perhaps. I'm a part of the academic diaspora. I got a PhD at Harvard in the plastics department in the mid-70s, and with the job drought went into law and have been involved in the political world a good bit in the last 10 or 15 years. So I'll just say that it tells you an awful lot about real-life politics, and I hope you'll mention The Light and the Dark. I think that's his best novel. Love that.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Thanks for your call, Michael. Let me just remind you, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What do you think of that, Phil?
Well, I was in one of the small p political. What intrigued me was that Snow, who was a man of the left, he does make a few allusions to some of the fellows' specific political affiliations are mentioned, and
right.
they don't at all comport with what we would think. I mean, the man of the left doesn't necessarily behave like our caricature of a man of the left, and the sort of putative Tory among the fellows is not someone I necessarily expected, which is at least what I thought was a kind of interesting twist. Beyond that, though, as I say, the specific politics of the 1930s, I think, are very much off stage in this novel, even though they are mentioned peripherally.
They're mentioned, and certainly as far as Jago is concerned, you have a sense that Jago thinks that we're headed for war, that we should be involved, that mm-hmm. we need to get out front, that we can't let this sort of happen without our involvement. And I think the other fellows who do not support him are rather fearful of that stance.
Well, I don't know if it's fearful of that stance because they don't want to resist fascism. I think it's more they just don't like the idea of the college being thrust headlong into national service in that way. I think they want to retain a sort of monastic academic atmosphere, and they're not interested in involving themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a characteristic of American higher education, to stay out of the political. That's changing now, but a few years ago, it would have been precisely the concept that they not be involved, not use their positions to do that.
Francis, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking back to what happened to Cambridge during the war, and of course, Snow was writing after the war, but go into King's College and you learn that every single one of those remarkable windows was taken out and I think stored in caves, you know, and underground in order to preserve the architecture of that place. There was, as Philip says, a great sense that the place was sacred in a sense.
Interesting. Here is an email from Elizabeth who says, I read the whole C.P. Snow series when I was in college. It inspired my ongoing search for novels about women at work. There are not many of them, and many of them are written by men.
Mm-hmm. Well, Henry James was one of the greatest novelists of women, so
he had
you never
a
know.
Particular view. You're absolutely right. Well, I want to thank you all so much, Milton Greenberg, Professor Emeritus of Government at American University, Frances Steed Sellers. She's at the Washington Post. Philip Terzian is at the Weekly Standard. The novel we've been talking about is by C.P. Snow. It is The Masters. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thank for you. Next month's Reader's Review, a new film adaptation of Jane Eyre has just hit movie screens. Our next Reader's Review will return to the pages of Charlotte Bronte's 1847 story of an orphan turned governess and her struggle to live an independent life. I hope you'll join me Wednesday, April 27. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.